Good evening. The United Auto Workers is on strike against General Motors. Will others follow? Where is Congress as Trump says America is locked and loaded for war with Iran and militarization on the border threatens the Constitution? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Monday, September 16th, 2019. The AFL-CIO announced solidarity for striking auto workers on Monday. The workers are supporting nearly 50,000 at a General Motors who are striking at General Motors plants in the U.S. and went on strike on Monday. The strike came after about 200 plant-level union leaders voted unanimously in favor of a walkout during a meeting in Detroit.
My name is Ted Crum. I'm the chair.
The UAW is on strike, and I want to be clear about this. We're on strike for fair wages.
My name is Ted Crum. I'm the chair of the UAW GM National Negotiations Team. Today I represent tens of thousands of UAW members who are sacrificing their comfort, their life, and their future by standing up for what is right. Behind us is the National Negotiations Team elected by members in plants across the country to represent them in these negotiations. I'd like to thank President Jones, Vice President Terry Dittes, going above and beyond to make sure our voices were at the negotiations table and at all times. I want to be clear about something. This strike is about us. It is about standing up for fair wages, for affordable quality health care, for our share of profits, and for our job security. We are standing with our brothers and sisters who are who are temporary employees and in progression employees who do the same work we do for less pay. We are united, we are strong, we are ready, we don't take this lightly. But General Motors needs to understand that we stood up for GM when they needed us. These are profitable times, we work hard to make this company profitable, and we deserve a fair contract because we've helped make this company what it is. We're standing up for us, we make no mistake. The strike is about the members in Texas, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and throughout the great nation. We're fighting for the future of the middle class, and we want a fair and equitable contract. Thank you.
UAW spokesman Brian Rothenberg said Sunday evening that contract talks would resume at 10 a.m. Monday, but the strike would go ahead.
The UAW is on strike, and I want to be clear about this. We're on strike for fair wages. We're on strike over affordable quality health care issues. We are at strike over our issues of our share of profits. We are at strike over our issue of job security. We're on strike over the issue of a defined path to permanent seniority for temporary workers.
GM on Friday offered to build new all-electric pickup truck at a factory and build a new all-electric pickup truck at a factory in Detroit that is slated to close next year. The automaker also offered to open an electric vehicle battery plant in Lordstown, Ohio, where it has a plant that has already stopped making cars. The closures, especially of the Ohio plant, have become issues in the 2020 presidential campaign. President Donald Trump has consistently criticized the company and demanded that Lordstown be reopened. On Saturday, the union's chief bargainer said in a letter, both the union and GM were far apart on issues such as wages, health care, temporary employees, job security, and profit sharing. Economist Jack Rasmus says this is a serious strike that could have ramifications for the economy and the labor movement.
Well, it does look like it may turn out to be a major strike. We haven't seen anything like this by the auto workers for decades. The last strike was in 2007, but that was only a let-off-the-steam couple-day affair. This looks like it's real because the issues are significant and they're wide apart on a lot of issues. So that sort of portends it's going to be a serious event. And of course, the auto workers are really concerned about a number of things. One, the fact that ever since they've been making concessions since 2008 to GM and the other auto companies, they've created a two-tier wage, two-citizen employment structure there where where all the new hires basically have come on as a temp or low-paid workers, and now they want to close that gap, you know, and you can't blame them. GM's made $12 billion in profits last year. But GM, you know, is closing down plants, four of them, and it's really about the auto industry entering a new juncture in which they're going to try to shift over to electric vehicles and longer-term self-driving vehicles. And, you know, the auto workers are concerned that those new plants, they're shutting down four plants, and where are they going to open the new ones? And they're concerned it's not going to be in Michigan or Detroit or anywhere traditionally. You know, Detroit used to be called Motor City, but now there's no factories at all, auto factories at all in Detroit. The last one, Hamtramck, just got shut down. So there's a lot of real issues. You know, they haven't shared in any of the profits, which have been significant for GM for a decade now. Big job security issues about closing the plants. Big issues about two-tier workforce. You know, other issues of profit sharing and health benefits. As always, companies want to shift more of the cost to health benefits onto the backs of their workers. That's an issue here as well.
Now, President,
so it looks like a real strike may develop out of this. We'll see.
Now, President Trump has you know, sort of styled himself as the rich guy who understands the needs and the pain of the working man, and has gotten a lot of blue collar support. Where does he stand on this? I mean, he wanted to open up the Lordstown plant, keep them from closing it down and moving it away. Where does this stand in far, you know, his policies and his approach to the economy?
Well, I mean, his true position you can see in the trade deals he's negotiated so far with South Korea, Canada, Mexico, and now just recently the understanding with Japan and so forth. When it comes to auto jobs, he's done nothing to bring back these auto jobs. Softball deal with South Korea, no restrictions on their auto imports to the U.S. Canada, he's upped the quota that Canadian production can ship cars to the U.S. In Mexico, he's got this phony deal about they have to raise wages of auto workers over there, but over 5 years and only for 40% of the workforce. He let the Europeans off the hook here for auto imports, and the same thing with Japanese. So it's a phony deal. It's a phony trade deal. In all cases, nothing to help you know, bring jobs back or protect the jobs of the auto workers. And you know, we see him making these statements, you know, about Lordstown, just as he's made statements about Carrier Corporation and others, but they never turn out to be anything. They're just PR events, and he does nothing to help them. And of course, he's going to be helping his buddies at GM. Make no mistake of that. But he says things to try to get public identification that he's for something, but he never follows through on it, you see. So he's not going to help these auto workers out, and probably will play a role in harming them before the whole thing is over. But, you know, his whole trade policy is except for China, you know, is phony. He's not bringing any of the jobs back, and that means the auto jobs as well.
Meanwhile, federal agents expanded an investigation of corruption within the U.S. auto industry Wednesday by raiding locations in four states, including the suburban Detroit home of United Auto Workers President Gary Jones and California home of former President Dennis Williams. The four-year investigation into bribes, kickbacks, and attempts by auto executives to influence labor negotiations with the UAW has led to charges against nine people and prison sentences for eight figures linked to the UAW and Fiat Chrysler automobiles. Rasmus says it's a time-honored tactic to bring criminal charges against union leaders on the eve of a major strike.
Yeah, you shouldn't take that as gospel truth simply because they do that. This is a tactic that the business class and their politicians sometimes use if it's a real important issue. And to try to extend that litigation based upon regional lower-level union officials. By the way, it was the Chrysler officials who really instigated that and implicated the union officials in it. They fell for it. They're always trying to trap union leaders into illegal activity to get rid of them. But I don't believe, you know, without some very hard evidence that there's anything that indicates the national leadership of the auto workers, and particularly the negotiators and GM here, is really legitimate at this point. People should think of that as a tactic to weaken the union, attack the leadership. But it may be that the auto workers have just had enough, you know, had enough of the company making these huge profits, had enough with two classes of pay, had enough with assuming more and more health care costs, just had enough with it. We'll see. It may be a seminal strike.
Economist Jack Rasmus, he's the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope, among other books. His website is jackrasmus.com. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In breaking news, the Manhattan DA's office has subpoenaed Donald Trump's tax returns. Cy Vance's office sent the subpoena to Trump's accounting firm seeking the last 8 years of state and federal tax returns for Trump and his company, the Trump Organization. Asked about the subpoena as he left the White House on Monday, Trump said, "I don't know anything about it." Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, said in a statement that it will respect the legal process and fully comply with its legal obligations. President Donald Trump on Monday said it looked like Iran was behind attacks on oil plants in Saudi Arabia over the weekend. The attacks raised fear of renewed conflict in the Middle East.
Mr. President, have you seen evidence, proof that Iran was behind the attack?
Well, it's looking that way. We'll have some pretty good, we're having some very strong studies done, but it's certainly looking that way at this moment. And we'll let you know. As soon as we find out definitively, we'll let you know. But it does look that way.
Do you want war with Iran?
Do I want war? I don't want war with anybody. I'm somebody that would like not to have war. We have the strongest military in the world. We've spent more than $1.5 trillion in the last short period of time on our military. Nobody's even come close. We have the best equipment in the world. We have the best missiles. And as you say, you just bought the Patriot system. There's nothing even close. No, I don't want war with anybody, but we're prepared more than anybody. 2.5 years ago, I will tell you, it was not the same thing. And with what we've done, we've totally rebuilt our military in so many different ways, but we've rebuilt it. And there's nobody that has the F-35. We have the best fighter jets, the best rockets, the best missiles, the best equipment. But with all of that being said, we'd certainly like to avoid it.
Iran has rejected U.S. charges it was to blame for the attacks, which damaged the world's biggest crude processing plant in Saudi Arabia and triggered the largest jump in crude prices in decades. But as the administration contemplates a major war, some are asking, where is Congress? Since the end of the Vietnam War, presidents have been constrained from declaring war by the War Powers Resolution. That's because Congress must vote on any major commitment of military force. Francis Boyle is professor at the University of Illinois College of Law.
Trump seems to be threatening war against Iran with no authorization from Congress to do so. Under those circumstances, a war would violate the War Powers Clause of the United States Constitution that requires some type of authorization from Congress, either a formal declaration of war, as we had after Pearl Harbor, or authorization under the War Powers Resolution. If you read the War Powers Resolution, the president is authorized to use military force to defend the United States in the event of an attack upon the United States, its territories, possessions, or armed forces. That's the direct language. But that is not the case here. There has been no attack on anything related to the United States of America, so he has no authorization to go to war, and indeed going to war under these circumstances would be an impeachable offense under the impeachment clause of the United States Constitution. What he's threatening here is retaliation, not self-defense. Now, the Trump people have said, well, you know, we have to defend Saudi Arabia. But this is retaliation. It is not self-defense. And indeed, the United States government has officially taken the position that retaliation and reprisal are not self-defense. So it would also violate the terms of the United Nations Charter Article 2, Paragraph 4, the threat and use of force. Article 2, Paragraph 3, an obligation for the to negotiate in a peaceful resolution of international disputes. And that, too, would be an impeachable offense because it violates a treaty to which the United States government is a party and the supreme law of the land. Right now, he has no authority from anyone to do anything with respect to Saudi Arabia. Indeed, we do not even have a self-defense treaty with Saudi Arabia. So we're not under any legal obligation to do anything here except to use our good auspices to try to promote a peaceful resolution of this dispute. As of now, it does not appear that is what we are doing. Pompeo immediately came out and blamed Iran with no evidence whatsoever. Then Trump said we're locked and loaded. So who is giving the president proper advice as to how to proceed here? Bolton was fired. Well, thank heavens for that. But his deputy, Kupperman, has taken over, is just as big a warmonger and a militarist as Bolton. I don't see where the restraint is coming here on this president and his circle of advisors. You'll note on the shoot down of that drone by the Iranians, we came within 10 minutes of what could have been a catastrophic war between the United States and Iran. And it's the same thing today. And I would ask today, where are the congressional leadership in both the House and the Senate here? I've been working all day today, but as of getting up this morning, I haven't seen Pelosi and Schumer and any of the other Durbin or any of the other leaders of the House or the Senate saying that the president has no authority to wage war here against Iran. Senator Sanders did, to his credit. I noticed Tulsi Gabbard this morning said something. Where is everyone else?
What is the War Powers Act?
It was enacted into law to deal with the Vietnam War and the Korean War in particular. The two of them together, if you read the legislative history, Truman went to war in Korea with no authorization from Congress, and 36,000 American men died. And we know almost nothing at all about that except the TV series MASH, where it's all treated as a big joke or something like that. As for Vietnam, yes, President Johnson did concoct the non-existent Gulf of Tonkin incident, lied to Congress, and then got a resolution of support, and he used that as a blank check to wage massive warfare against Vietnam that eventually murdered 58,000 young men of my generation and exterminated 3 million Vietnamese and then large numbers of Laotians and Cambodians. It was passed over the veto of President Nixon, so two-thirds of each house passed it, was intended to prevent another Korean War or a Vietnam War. Well, if President Trump were to attack Iran, we're going to have a major conflict because the Iranians, they're armed, equipped, supplied, and well-motivated, and they are battle-hardened. They fought a terrible war against Iraq that at Saddam Hussein that, by the way, we encouraged and we supported Saddam Hussein in that war. It's an extremely dangerous situation. War powers were lodged directly into the hands of Congress, not the president. And the president was made commander-in-chief of U.S. Armed Forces only when authorized to go to war by Congress or in the event of a sudden attack on the United States, when Congress could not meet to authorize war.
Francis Boyle is professor at the University of Illinois College of Law. In more national news, immigration officials apprehended just over 64,000 migrants at the southern border in August, a dramatic drop that the Trump administration is presenting as a sign its diplomatic engagement with Mexico and other countries is having a positive effect on the ground. Meanwhile, the number of caravans has also dropped. In May, 48 caravans of migrants were recorded coming to the U.S. In August, the tally was 6. Border Patrol now has fewer than 5,000 migrants in custody, down from 19,000 at the peak in the spring. At home, the U.S. is pushing through a change to the Flores-Corta settlement, which limits how long minors can be kept in custody. as well as a rule that says that migrants cannot claim asylum if they have passed through other safe countries. It's also eyeing expanding DNA tests on migrants claiming to be family units. Democratic presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke, who hails from Texas, spoke recently on a Virginia radio station. He says if elected, he would rethink border wall construction.
There are more than 600 miles of wall and fencing and physical barriers now along that 2,000-mile border. And where they are not working, where, in fact, in El Paso, we saw crime actually go up after the wall was constructed instead of coming down. It made us less, not more safe. As an El Pasoan, I, for one, would want to take much of that wall down. If there are other places where a physical barrier from the community's perspective is necessary or helpful and it already exists, I would defer to them. And unfortunately, it's not just Republicans who've advocated and voting for building walls here. Democrats voted for the Secure Fence Act that provided the authorization and ultimately the funding to build the walls that we have.
Journalist Todd Miller has authored several books on militarization of America's border walls. He says construction has been as popular under Democrats as Republicans. He adds that Trump has just perfected the call and that the result has undermined the U.S. Constitution.
The United States border is probably a lot more expansive than what people might think it is. I assume that most people automatically think about the U.S. southern border with Mexico, and it's true that it's that, but it's also it also goes up the coast. It's the Canadian, the 4,000-mile Canadian border, and it's thicker than one might think. The border zone is actually 100 miles inland. So if you think about the U.S.-Mexico border and you go 100 miles inland and you imagine a band going around, say, the contours of the United States, that is actually the border zone where Border Patrol can operate, where Border Patrol can put up checkpoints, where Border Patrol could, if they are in your area, pull you over and ask you questions. And that's the zone that the ACLU calls a constitution-free zone due to the mangling, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution that protects you from being searched or seized.
Former Vice President Biden the other day at the debate, he said that there was not the Obama did not lock people in cages. But you say that, in fact, this goes back 25 years, this militarization of the border. Is that true?
When Biden said that during the debate, he was not. Unfortunately, he was not telling the truth. The Obama administration has been locked up people in cages. By that, meaning they're in detention when people cross the border all throughout the Obama administration. And on top of that, no other president has deported more people than President Obama. Almost 3 million people were deported under his administration. Deportations means being deported from the country often, if not highly likely, means that you are separated from family members, loved ones. So the separation of families was very much prevalent, as well as being caged. Right, because in Immigration and Customs Enforcement, detention centers, people spend sometimes years behind bars. So those comments by Biden were not only not true, they obscure something that's been going on, as you just mentioned, for more than 25 years, but very prominently in the last 25 years, there's been a almost turbocharged buildup of the U.S. border apparatus, and that's in terms of building walls and fences. And there's, before Trump ever took office, there was 650 miles of walls and barriers already on the U.S.-Mexico border. There's billions of dollars of technology deployed there. Border Patrol went from 4,000 agents to 21,000 agents. It's the largest federal law enforcement agency in the United States. So all these changes have happened over the last 25 years. And it's what Biden and Obama and Trump is a very much a manifestation of a bigger system of border enforcement that began with operations during the Clinton administration, Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line, and then was bolstered in the post-9/11 era under the George W. Bush administration, and then really continued and further bolstered by the Obama administration. And now I would argue that Trump is its finest manifestation. Finest, I mean that in the most sarcastic of senses. You know, that Trump is now a manifestation of what has been building up for the last 25 years.
What's behind all this? What's been driving this obsession with guarding the borders?
It's actually, as you point out, a very recent phenomenon, this almost obsession with guarding the borders and making, you know, making sure there's enforcement on the borders. And it's almost as if there has never been a time when there hasn't been all the Border Patrol agents and all the technologies and, you know, everything that's deployed there now, as if it's always been there since the beginning of history. It's really a recent thing, like you said. There's many different ways you can look at it. The border issues are complex. But one thing that I've been looking at is looking at the last 25 years, if you look at the budgets, if you look at the budget for border and immigration enforcement in, say, 1994, it was $1.5 billion. And that was under the Clinton administration when those operations started to happen. And then if you fast forward to last year, 2018, the border and immigration budget was $23 billion. And that's if you take Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement and add them together, $23 billion. So that's been a massive historic increase of budgets. And one of the things that has happened, Customs and Border Protection gave out approximately $27 billion in contracts to private entities, to corporations, to companies like Lockheed Martin, like Boeing, like Northrop Grumman, like the Israeli company Elbit Systems, just to name a few. Those companies also have a lot of clout in Washington. They're able to get behind closed doors of key congressional figures. They're able to get in the House Homeland Security Committee. They're able to get into the Appropriations Committee, into offices of members of the Appropriations Committee. And Appropriations, of course, decides who doles out what money to who. That's how budgets are thought up. The sort of influence these companies who are getting contracts also have in Washington, as far as policy is concerned, has to be considered when we're looking at immigration reform, has to be considered when we're reckoning with this, the most massive immigration and border enforcement regime we've ever had. If there are many profit-making entities involved in anything, it becomes a complex. In and unto itself, it will want to grow. And that part of it has to be thought about.
Where is this going to go?
Right now, if things stay the same, it's just going to continue growing. Companies are going to keep profiting. And there's going to be more and more surveillance technologies, walls, agents, armed agents on the borders. People don't necessarily want that to happen.
Journalist Todd Miller has authored several books on militarization of America's borders. And finally, Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren is campaigning in New York. She's delivering a speech this evening at 7 p.m. under the arch in Washington Square Park. She'll announce anti-corruption measures calling for a remake in how the government does business. While Bernie Sanders calls for a full political revolution, Warren seeks a remake of the system. She'll speak about how the rich and powerful have been allowed to tilt the rules. And that's some of the news for Monday, September 16th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.